The food processing industry rests on three pillars: salt, sugar, and fat. From spaghetti sauce to soda pop, researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health found that every processed food lining the shelves of our favorite grocery store is rich in these ingredients. We can't resist them, and we don't always know they're there. Hello, I'm Rakhaya Najjar, and you're listening to the extended version of The Heat, the Producers Podcast. Today we're discussing the food processing industry, and joining me is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Moss. Moss spent 4 years investigating the science behind processed food and published his findings in a best-selling book, Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Also joining us is Anna Lappe. Lappe is a best-selling author and educator known for her work as a sustainable food advocate and co-founder of the Small Planet Institute. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Michael, I'm going to start with you. The U.S. government message to us over the years has been cut back on saturated fat, cut back on cholesterol, on salt, on sugar. But that clearly hasn't worked, has it?
No, I mean, that message is really put out there as a whisper compared to the opposite direction, getting us to eat foods that are industrial produced, laden with salt, sugar, and fat. And so the poor consumer has been hearing that latter message and not the whispering.
Now, I know you've done a lot of work with children and how food is marketed to children.
Well, what we've seen happening is that the food industry likes to say that it's marketing less to children. What really is happening is that they're shifting where those ad dollars are going. So shifting from some of the traditional sources of advertising that in a way are very straightforward. So television advertising, for instance, they're shifting away from that to more what I would call stealth advertising or surreptitious advertising. So that's things like reaching children online, through social media, through literally their peer network. So engaging young people to kind of sell other young people on this junk food. They're doing things like McDonald's banner website, happymeal.com, is a website aimed at preschoolers that effectively is marketing for McDonald's.
And so when kids get hooked on these brands, it is staying with them throughout their entire lives.
Yeah. Well, Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, he's famous for saying, if you have a dollar to spend on marketing, spend it on children. And in Michael's book, he does such a fabulous job of showing this really incredible power of once you kind of get hooked on this food early, you really are consumers for a lifetime. And so that's why talking about how do we rein back that marketing to children is so important.
Michael, now you wrote an entire book, as Anna mentioned, how the industry markets these products to the world, these unhealthy, addictive products everywhere. How is that possible? How do they do that?
Well, thanks, Anna. And I think Anna's got that right. And interesting, there's no company that the food manufacturers admire more in terms of their marketing power than Coca-Cola. And I spent time with a former president of Coca-Cola for North America, South America, who walked me through Coke's original marketing plans, which was to put a Coke in the hands of children at the moment where they're having one of the best times of their lives in sports stadiums. And today, while Coca-Cola can proudly say, look, we're cutting back on our marketing of advertising directed at kids below the ages of 12, they are still targeting kids in corner stores, convenience stores, knowing that when a child walks into the store with a little bit of their own spending money and makes that first decision about what to buy, they will become brand loyal. And so one of the takeaway messages I got from the research and reporting for the book was that this is an industry that's been driving to get us not just to like their products, but to want more and more of them. And it's an industry that itself is incredibly dependent on huge amounts of salt, sugar, and fat to keep us hooked on their stuff.
Now, when these food scientists were creating these products, were they remotely aware, was there any evidence that they knew they were addictive and unhealthy?
Yeah, no, I think that in some inherent way, they weren't. And they defend themselves to me in the book by explaining that, look, when we invented some of these products, and they call them engineering, by the way, not inventing. When we engineered some of these products for maximum sort of allure, we did so often in a more innocent era when people's dependence on fast food, convenience food, was much less than it was today. And so suddenly a product that used to be an occasional treat has become an everyday, many times a day sort of phenomena. And I think they can justly say that things moved on to them partly because of the power of the products.
Anna, when you talk about marketing, let's get into more specifics because I think it's important here. I watched a TED Talk, one you gave in Manhattan, and you actually said that you found a relationship between the marketing to children and UNICEF, of all people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. When you start digging into this, you start seeing kind of some unholy partnerships that surprise you. I remember discovering there was a partnership a few years ago where Coca-Cola gave the American Dietetic, the American Dentist Association millions of dollars. So one of the things that you see, again, sort of in that stealth marketing way the industry works now, is you start seeing these food companies giving millions of dollars in charity to groups that are on the surface really about promoting children's health. But what you see is that when you have a company like Coca-Cola spending several million dollars to a children's hospital, for instance, that is just a rounding error in the revenue that they make every year. So these companies are spending a few million dollars on the one hand while they're spending billions on the other to market their products. I mean, just to give you one example, I was looking at the ad budget for Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, and that company spent more in 1 year marketing Frosted Flakes to children than the American Centers for Disease Control spent that same year in their program for obesity prevention, nutrition, and physical activity. So you're just talking about a playing field that is not level. You're talking about, again, just so much marketing aimed at children and done in these very stealthy ways.
Michael, back to your book, one of the things that you wrote about was this fascination with a completely new food category. And you were really intrigued by Kraft's near billion-dollar lineup of Lunchable snack food trays. Why? Why was that so fascinating? And keep in mind that some listeners may not know what those are.
Lunchables is a TV dinner type tray that Oscar Mayer, and then acquired by Kraft, began making back in the 80s to sell to parents to give to their kids initially as a treat to eat at school. And it's typically made of small pieces of meat, cheese, crackers, to be eaten cold on the lunchroom. It then morphed into things like pancakes and pizza and hot dog and hamburger Lunchables, all to be eaten cold. And while some versions of the over the years have been extremely loaded with amounts of salt, sugar, fat, and kudos for Kraft for cutting back a little bit on that, it sort of ushered in this era of food in the grocery store that's mimicking fast food. And I think that nutritionists have seen this as a huge threat to families wanting to do better by their own health and their family's health. Because look, we walk into the grocery store and I think we instinctively lower our guard and think that products in there are there to make us healthier. And things have changed over the years.
Things certainly have changed. And you know, one thing we've noticed is that the food industry is behaving in many respects like the tobacco industry. The campaign against smoking has been relatively successful in the United States. And what happened is that they then took their product and started marketing it to developing countries, you know, places like the Philippines. Is that what the processed food industry is doing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are a lot of parallels. And you're right. I mean, what you're starting to see is that there has been some relative progress in this country in terms of people waking up to this public health crisis, people standing up to these companies, people really trying to improve access and affordability of healthy food in our communities. So what you are seeing is exactly what you described. You're seeing these companies starting to look overseas and see these developing countries and new markets as a potential gold mine. And so what we're witnessing is this sort of exportation of this American diet, as Michael describes it, you know, this high fat, high salt, high sugar diet, into countries whose healthcare systems are already struggling to deal with the healthcare issues that afflict those countries. And now they're starting to deal with our sort of very American diet healthcare issues. You look at a country like Mexico, it has the highest per capita consumption of Coca-Cola and has rates of obesity that rival ours. And so one of the things that we stress is that if we are really serious about trying to reverse this epidemic of diet-related illnesses, we can't do it on a country-by-country basis. We really have to work across the globe to realize that, you know, these are companies that are working globally to expand their market, so we also have to organize globally.
It's really something to behold because, you know, you took a country like Japan, which arguably had one of the best diets in the world, and they're now experiencing obesity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you could go down the list, Japan, China, Mexico, India, Brazil, where I've done some research. And again, what you're finding is that there's just been this real expansion of the power of these companies. You know, you talk about a sort of unprecedented consolidation in the food industry, where fewer and fewer food dollars are going into the hands of fewer and fewer companies that have this incredible power through their trade associations, through their lobbying arms, to influence regulation, whether that's on the national scale or the international scale.
Michael, I was looking at something that you'd written, and I just want to bring up that analogy with the tobacco industry again, because you said that states accused the tobacco industry of a wide range of deceptive and fraudulent practices. And they rallied behind the state's attorney general, Michael Moore, who said that the lawsuit was premised on a single notion: you caused the health crisis, you pay for it.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting because, look, I mean, I don't see this food industry as this evil empire, well, at least not all of the companies, who is sort of intentionally set out to make us overweight or otherwise ill. But on the other hand, I don't see them suddenly getting all philanthropic on us. If they are going to change and start making truly better products, I think that impetus is going to come from a money standpoint, and maybe like the states did with tobacco, which is arguing, look, you caused this problem, you're overloading our healthcare systems, you're going to have to pay for it.
Anna Lappe, Michael Moss, you've certainly given us a lot to chew on. Thank you again. Be sure to catch Michael and Anna's live interview with Anand this Friday, 7 a.m. Beijing, 7 p.m. Eastern. Feel free to tweet me your questions in advance at Rukaya N or email me at rsn@cctv-america.com.